HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, and not just because I happen to be a fan of Good Morning America, and our guest for the next few minutes happens to be a producer for Good Morning America, Mary Flum Peterson. But quite apart from the good work which she has done for Good Morning America for a number of years now, and for many years before that at CNN, Mary Flum Peterson has written an absolutely extraordinary book, which is a memoir about her life, and especially the life which she has had with her mother, a mother who unquestionably has loved her all along, and yet a mother who was in many ways broken and fragile in so many ways that Mary, especially as she was growing up, couldn't begin to understand. And Mary's mother did all that she could to cope with all kinds of demons and pressures, including the pressure of being a single mother under very, very difficult circumstances. And the troubles that she had led to long bouts of terrible, crippling depression, and also to what ended up being the life of a hoarder to a very, very serious degree. And so much of this was unfolding or unraveling as Mary Flum Peterson's professional star was soaring. And that's one of the great ironies of this story, as Mary Flum Peterson was enjoying great success, first at CNN and then at Good Morning America. She has this mother who is coping with all of these problems and difficulties. And what was she to do? What was the best way in which she could somehow try to help her mother through this difficult journey? The name of this memoir is called White Dresses, a memoir of love and secrets, mothers and daughters. And I've read many books, in a sense, like it, but I don't ever remember reading a memoir that impressed me so much for its frank honesty and yet loving compassion about the people about whom it's written. This book is published by William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins, now available in paperback. And I'm very happy to say, for the next few minutes, welcome Mary Flum Peterson to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored to be with you today. Thank you.
And I meant what I said, that I think it is so difficult to write a memoir that, on the one hand, is open and frank, disarmingly frank sometimes, about the fragility and the failings of, for instance, one's own parents, and at the same time somehow couching that frankness and openness and honesty in love and compassion and understanding. I just wonder how much you struggled with that particular question and challenge as you sat down to write this memoir.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of people have asked me that, and the book really, I don't mean to make it sound overly simplistic, but the book really wrote itself. I had taken a class at my children's preschool. There was a writing course offered when my kids were in session. I have four small children. I was polishing off a novel that I had written, a totally different kind of book, and thought it would be a nice opportunity to just meet some new people. I wrote an in-class essay that was a timed essay to warm us up. It was the second or third class of the session. They wanted me to write about how I got my name. So I wrote about my name being Mary, and my mother had chosen the name, and it came in large part because of her years in the convent. She was a Catholic nun for nearly 10 years, obviously before I came along. When I wrote this, the class was really moved. A couple of women in the class actually cried, and these were otherwise seemingly hearted New Yorkers, and they said, "You really have something special there. Tell us more about your mom." My mother had recently died, and I took a deep breath, and my writing instructor asked at the time as well. She said, "Was this hard for you to write?" I said, "No." And she said, "Well, I think you found your voice. Follow this, please." You know, she was okay with the novel, too, but she said, "Just put that to the side for a moment and follow this, because you're striking a chord." And so what I started doing, I'm a mother of four. I'm a producer at Good Morning America. I don't have a lot of time. I don't sleep a lot. I wrote, I'd say at least 30% of the book came out on my phone. I tapped away, I emailed it to myself, but it really flowed. To the point that my wonderful editors and publisher at HarperCollins, they really felt like they didn't have to do much when they saw it. It just kind of flowed out of me. Now, the harder part, of course, came in realizing that, oh, my goodness, I just wanted to make sure if a lot of people were going to see this, that they got it. And by got it, I mean that my family is not unique in that it's complex. Most families, I think, I say, show me a family that's not complex, and I would argue, you know, you're not showing the full story of the family. But my family was very complicated, and I wanted to make sure that I did everybody justice and still told the true and authentic story. And so that became my bigger concern. It wasn't as difficult as people might think writing about what happened. It was my story. It was my family's story, and it was a story that my mother was never ashamed of. She kept many things secret and private, but she always believed in us being ourselves, and she always believed that what a person went through made that person who they were and got that person to where they were and with the people that they loved that surrounded them. So she had ingrained that in me pretty deeply, and also I think being a journalist, it was ingrained in me pretty deeply that you need to tell the truth. That's the story. But I think the harder part was just getting ready for publication and just working with my team and working with some of my my very special friends who were first readers of the book to make sure that they felt like, hey, I got it. And I think one of my most edifying moments was I got a personal email from Anna Quinlan, who I respect quite a bit, and she let off by saying she loved it and then went on to say, I don't usually like memoirs because they tend to either be too generous and you don't feel like you had the whole truth, or too you know, looking for flaws in everyone, maybe trying to you know, grind an axe, and she felt like it was beautifully balanced. So I appreciate that both you and Anna Quinlan felt like I got it right.
I admire her very much. I've interviewed her on a couple of occasions, and so I can only second what she said. I think you really achieved something, because in a sense it is the sometimes kind of horrifying details that sort of in some ways sort of grab the headlines or might initially grab our attention. And yet underneath it all is this fabric of love and appreciation and striving to understand why your mother, first of all, was the person she was and why she did the things she did, and why in the end, in some ways, at least by the standards of the world, she maybe might have seemed like a failure in some respects as a mother. In so many other ways, she was not. I wonder if you could say a word about the title of the book, White Dresses, and in particular, the really intriguing moment with which the book begins, the introduction. Tell our listeners about these white dresses and, in a sense, what they symbolize amidst this story.
Well, thank you for that question. I think white dresses came to me very quickly is what the title of the book would be. I wrote the back half of my book first. I realized more of my story, and then wrote the front half, but more my mother's story second. I realized that the fabric of my life with my mother, the women in our family, was really tied together by white dresses. We're a Catholic family, and so like most Catholic families, white dresses played a huge role in our lives. I think white dresses play a huge role, I know from talking to my friends of other faiths as well, in many women's lives within a family. Big moments in our life were celebrated with white dresses. We begin with my mother's baptism dress. We go through her first communion dress, her graduation dress, the white dress she wore when she became a nun, the white dress she wore when she married my father. And then we continue on with the white dresses I wore, my baptism dress, my first communion dress, my graduation dress, and wedding dress, and ultimately with my young daughter's white baptism dress. But these dresses were worn on very significant days of our lives that were often made up of highs and lows. They marked extremely important milestones, and they were so important to my mother because my mother loved white. She believed white represented faith and hope and, above all, endless possibilities. She loved, loved, loved the idea of even a white canvas. She loved the musical Sunday in the Park with George from Stephen Sondheim, and it's a wonderful line where, in referring to George Surratt, who the musical is about, that his favorite thing was not a finished painting, but was a blank canvas, was white, because there were so many possibilities. And she felt like that about life. So no matter how dark and awful some things in our life as a family became, she still believed in the hope of new possibilities. So you put on that white dress, and this is an important day. And she wasn't one to dwell on the bad. She was always one to look for the good. And I think all of that was epitomized in white dresses. And you asked me about the introduction of the book. When my mother died, she died very suddenly. She died in December of 2010, and it was a shock to all of us. And she died at a time in which we'd been trying desperately to get her help from the compulsive hoarding that had really just gotten its arms wrapped around her and was strangling her pretty hard. She was functioning as a wonderful school teacher for the Slinger-Allenton School District. She did great, great work on the outside, but on the inside she was suffering and literally wouldn't let us in. For the last 10 years of my mother's life, I wasn't allowed back into the house, and we tried like mad to get her help. And I was very angry with the situation of the house. I felt like the house had swallowed my mother whole. So in the introduction to the book, it's a real scene. I was trying. We got to the house, and I was full of dread. It was after my mother's funeral, after her burial, and I was going into the house for the first time in more than 10 years. And my husband said to me, my wonderful husband, who was so supportive through all of this, you know, get what you absolutely need. It felt like going in, and I've covered a lot of disaster. I talk in the book. I covered some major earthquakes and hurricanes. I was there after Katrina. I was in a huge earthquake in Turkey that killed more than 20,000. But after the disaster, you just want those sentimental things. It's not the big things. And what I wanted were the white dresses. I didn't know if they had survived. The thing that happens with hoarding, and it goes into in the book, it's much like a fire or a flood or an earthquake. When hoarding really takes hold, there's a lot destroyed. Almost all of my baby pictures, for example, gone. I mean, so much destroyed because of just what happened to the house. So I was so worried that the white dresses would have been destroyed. I mean, there was a lot of very bad stuff that had happened to the home. And at the beginning of the book, it's what I realized, what I really wanted. If nothing else survived, I just wanted those white dresses. And so I was looking frantically for any of the white dresses that I talk about in the book. I had certainly my wedding gown was back in New York City where I lived with my husband and my children, but I wanted, for example, the white graduation dress. I was valedictorian in my high school class, and there's a very pivotal scene and chapter in the book about that dress and what it had meant to me. I called it my Daisy Buchanan white dress because I thought it was something Daisy Buchanan would have worn in The Great Gatsby. I wanted my first communion dress because I thought that dress was magic, and I still do. I wanted my mother's wedding gown for no other reason than to show my own daughter. I really believe in passing down what you can. So that's how the book opens, and it really gets to the heart of the significance and meaning of white dresses in my family.
We're speaking with Mary Flum Peterson about her memoir, White Dresses, a memoir of love and secrets, mothers and daughters. One of the things that helps us understand your mother's own kind of emotional and mental fragility is the fact that she grew up under somewhat difficult circumstances in a family in which her own mother, so your grandmother, had 5 babies in 6.5 years, and it was sort of an overwhelming gauntlet in many respects, and it's part of what ultimately led your own mother to make the decision to, in a sense, flee from that challenging home and off to a convent to become a nun, which ultimately ended up being one of the great nightmares of her life and further led her down a road of terrible difficulty. Can you just say a brief word about reaching back yet another generation and trying to understand your mother's own childhood? I think that's not an easy thing to do.
It wasn't. That was the hardest part about the book to put together. I knew a lot about, certainly, you know, I my mother, I was fortunate. I was always interested in history. I think I was, my mother jokes I was a journalist, you know, from the word go. I was always interviewing people. I always wanted to know more, you know, than just the surface answer, you know, certainly the kid that asks why, but you know, just wanted to know more about the story behind things and what made people tick. So I was fortunate. She told me a lot about her childhood. I was fortunate. Her mother really warmed up to me. Her mother had been, I think, like a lot of women in the Great Depression, when her mother became a mother, money was tight, dreams were dashed. She'd had to forego a college career. She dreamed of being a writer, so writing has really run in the family. And like a lot of women, you know, it's like the Betty Friedan's feminine mystique, you know, the problem, you know, that had no name. I think a lot of women in that generation were just frustrated from the word go, not only because they felt repressed and their brains were underutilized, but also because money was so tight. So my mother, I knew from both being a history major, I knew something of the time, and I knew my mother's stories. But to answer your question, I mean, a journalist in me, I wanted to get it right. I didn't want to just surmise. So I talked to her siblings, which was a fascinating process. I already knew them. But to talk to siblings about their upbringing, it's fascinating because everybody has a different take. There were certain common themes, and a couple of my mother's first cousins were also very helpful who'd been witness to a lot of it. Definitely there were common themes that my grandmother just really was overwhelmed and probably – even from what she told me when I was growing up, you know, probably wouldn't have gone for the 5 children in 6.5 years had there been a birth control pill available, had the Catholic Church not been so strict. That her passion was probably more about she really loved my mother's father, my grandfather, and she really loved to read and write, but some of the other homemaking things, not so much. But it was a challenge to, you know, try to come up with a picture that I felt like was fair without obviously having been there and with a lot of years having passed. And then as is the nature with any large family, there are not only different takes, but there's different, you know, different perceptions because of very different experiences growing up in the same house, some shades of sibling rivalry perhaps coming out. So that was very interesting for me to do. And fascinating, and I hope I did a fair amount of justice. What I tried to do, if nothing else, was just to remind people what my mother always told me, that there's no good guys or bad guys for the most part. She really doesn't ever believe on any level that life was black and white. That's a lot of shades of murky gray.
Mm, absolutely.
And so I tried to bring that out, and when there was a situation where something seemed harsh, I did my best as a journalist and as a daughter and granddaughter to explain a little bit of context, that something came from something, that someone wasn't just out and out rude or seemingly mean or seemingly too harsh or rigid, that there was some why or context given.
Right. Your mother, in the wake of a surprising breakup with a boyfriend whom she thought felt about her the way she did about him, falls into one of her first nervous breakdowns, ultimately joins this convent, has a very difficult time there. I mean, other such communities might have been much more loving, but this was an extremely strict environment in which your mother was almost emotionally abused in some ways, at least given her own fragility. And when she returns, finally leaving the convent, and you describe that in harrowing detail, even how difficult and painful the exit was, she returns to her parents, who don't know even what to tell their friends about their daughter who's left the convent. She had become, in your words, more complicated to love and more complicated to be around. She ultimately marries a man named Dale, your father, who ultimately turns out to be gay. And I do appreciate the tenderness with which you write about this and about his own difficulty living in a small community, actually part of the time in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, hiding such a secret from his own wife and from all of his friends and his coworkers and so on. This must have been an interesting journey for you emotionally as well, to kind of come to grips with this part of your father's life.
Oh, absolutely. And it, you know, one thing about my mother, without fail, she really worked to be very, very compassionate. She always worked to always have, you know, us as children, put ourselves in somebody else's shoes. That was really her whole church background, her faith background. And she that carried over into how she handled the situation with my father. She really, there's a scene in the book, and it was very emotional for my father to tell me he cried, and then I wound up crying. When you know, he tried to take his life a couple of times because he was living this secret life, and he'd been raised very Catholic. The book goes into some of the pressure he was feeling and why. He lost an older brother. He was the sole surviving son of a you know, very nice Catholic farm family in southern Indiana, and he felt like he needed to carry on the family name or else. And so I try to put some context there of why someone back then, it wasn't just the time in which, of course, so many people believed that nobody was really gay, but it was also a lot of family pressure, a lot of faith-related pressure, why he would knowingly marry my mother when he had thoughts going someplace else. But when he finally came out to my mother after a couple of these suicide attempts, my mother, my father said, you know, did something, he thinks it's the kindest thing anyone has ever said to him. And that was that obviously she was devastated, and she was very surprised. She really didn't think that he was gay. That's just not the way people were wired back then. I was just telling someone earlier, I think in this age, it's just a sidebar of, with Love Wins being the theme of the summer, and gay marriage now being a reality, I think it's easy for people to forget how recently many people just didn't think, you know, that anybody, or certainly many people, were gay. But in any case, when my father did come out, my mother took a deep breath, and stunned though she was, you know, said to him, you know, first she said, well, at least now we know what we're dealing with. And she was actually rather relieved to know what had been so troubling my father and what had been such a source of pain and difficulty in the marriage. And two, she went on to say, and that's where he really cried and I really cried, was, if I can accept who you are, why can't you? He was having such a hard time coming to terms with what his inner compass was telling him, and that's that he wasn't attracted to women, and this sounds so basic now, but back then that was a big deal. And so she was, for her to be so readily so forgiving and loving, just speaks volumes. And so she really passed that on to my brother and me, and to really anyone else who would listen. I mean, she made it very clear. There was one point my father said that one psychiatrist, again, this is back in the 80s, and when people just weren't thinking very progressively, he wanted to send my father to Canada to have my father fixed in a gay rehabilitation program. And my mother, even back then, knew that that was just crazy. She felt like, you know, this is who he is, and instead of fighting it, we're going to accept it, and we're going to, you know, we're going to love each other, and we're going to find a way through this. So I really, really credit her for being way ahead of her time in terms of, same with when the AIDS crisis was hitting. And I remember so many small-minded comments being made. There was so much hysteria. I remember Rock Hudson, and my mother had always loved him, and people making comments in our small town and at our church of, you know, the tongue wagging and the finger wagging, and my mother saying, Why should this make you, you know, no longer be a fan? You know, this is a human being. She was very, very, she was wearing a red ribbon before anybody else was. She was just a very compassionate woman in full. Very, very admirable.
One of the things that, of course, was difficult in the wake of your father leaving and ultimately the marriage being annulled is your mother was then a single mother. and really, in some ways, sort of cracked under the enormous weight of trying to make a life for you and your brother. You create such an interesting metaphor about her devotion to you, something akin to on an airplane when those in an unfortunate event and those oxygen masks come down and you're instructed to put it on yourself before you put it on your children's face. You feel like your mother did just the opposite, that in grappling with what she was trying to handle, she turned first to you and your brother and left herself last. And in a sense, that's part of what led to so many of her terrible difficulties. It's a really touching picture.
It is, and I went on to write, thank you for noting that part in the book, that not only, and I really believe this, not only would she have put our masks on first, I honestly believe in that situation, she would have been, and this is very much like her, she wouldn't have even put on her mask for fear that somehow that was taking away, you know, more oxygen from my brother and I. So even if there was one for her after she got us taken care of, I could just totally see her or just taking a sip here and there and not really ever allowing herself to take anything for herself. That was just how she was wired. And having become a mother, I do better understand that. I think there's it's a topic for a whole other show, just different kinds of parenting. I'm not saying right or wrong, but the way we're wired to really, you know, it's been a, you know, an old topic at this point about mothers putting their kids first and what that means, but she just took it to a totally different level, and I think that's how she got through. I think she felt like, looking back, I think she really felt like, especially after my father left, and how, and she was hospitalized a couple of times for subsequent, I don't know if you want to call them full-out breakdowns. I've been told that's what they were, but she was hospitalized again for a couple of summers because of the depression. I think she felt like she was drowning so much that I think she thought, well, listen, I'm not going to make it, or at least I'm never going to come back out the way I was. So at least, you know, gosh darn it, I'm going to have my kids make it, and they're going to make it, and that's going to be my mission, and I am going to die making sure they're okay. And that's really what happened. I want to note, I don't want this to sound like a sad story, because above all, the theme of White Dresses is, again, it's faith, it's new beginnings, it's her faith and belief. So it's, I think some people, as you noted earlier so astutely, you know, it's just the nature of the news business. I'm in the news business. I see it all the time. They cling to, like, the bad news nuggets of something. And in this case, there is sadness in the book, but there's also so much faith and love and hope. And so she definitely, you know, do I wish we could have done more to get her out of the situation at the end? Do I wish we could have helped her really see that, hey, your kids can be okay and you can be okay too? Absolutely. But do I think that that her hope above all was that she would get her kids okay? And get to a place where she would have grandchildren, and that this next generation would, you know, be able to learn something from her wonderful legacy, and that's above all to love one another and have compassion. Yes, So I think there's a lot of light and love of these three generations of White Dresses.
Absolutely, and I love one of the moments when you are working at CNN, talking about the incredible things that you are experiencing, and she tells you, you're doing things now that I will never do. You're going places that I will never go. She took such pride in the work that you have done, and that was one source of great comfort for her, that she ultimately was able to help you along to a much happier and in so many ways very successful life, and you in turn give her such credit for all that she gave to you. The book is White Dresses, a memoir of love and secrets, mothers and daughters, published by William Morrow. Mary Flum Peterson, thank you so much for crafting such a lovely and thought-provoking memoir.
Well, thank you for a wonderful conversation. I appreciate it so much.
And I'm very happy to say that author Mary Flum Peterson was willing to join me for a follow-up interview to answer a few more questions about her marvelous memoir, White Dresses. And in this follow-up interview, I began by asking her about some of the details of her mother's hoarding and whether or not she has come to understand just what might have been behind her mother's hoarding. What was compelling her to such behavior?
Those are both great questions and questions that I pondered certainly the last 10 to 15 years of her life and since she's died quite a bit. Hoarding is a really, really tough subject. It's one that I thought somehow if I made enough money, if I did well enough in my career as a TV journalist, with the partnership of my wonderful husband, who's a really bright and kind guy and he's an attorney, we thought we could wrap our arms around and lick. And hoarding isn't like that. I would liken hoarding to any number of other diseases. It doesn't kill you the way cancer does, but just as with any serious illness, it's tough, and you need some good experts on your side. It's not something you can take on by yourself. So anyone out there who is a hoarder or who loves a hoarder or whose neighbors or friends or acquaintances with a hoarder, I would just encourage you, to surround yourself with your own support team and your own support army. In the case of my mother, it started subtly, and I think it does with a lot of hoarders. When my father left, that's when I really noticed as a child the differences. My father would argue that there were some signs of hoarding when they were married, but when he left and I was only 8 or 9 years old, and that's when there was really like a distinct before and after. It started with mail. Mail would just never be opened or put away, all kinds of mail, and then the mail would pile up so high. She would put it in, she always loved the brown grocery bags as opposed to any plastic. So there was mail all over the house. She loved to read all of your wonderful Wisconsin papers, the Wisconsin State Journal, Milwaukee Journal, and Sentinel, as well as national papers like USA Today. Prolific reader, that's wonderful. She didn't want to get rid of anything that she read. So there were lots of newspapers, magazines. She subscribed to a lot. We didn't have a lot of money, but she was an educator and used those educator discounts to subscribe to Time, to Newsweek, to People. Anything she got a good rate on with those publisher clearinghouse deals, they were everywhere. She always thought there might be an article that she just had to hang on to. And then she was a teacher, so teachers by nature have lots of school reports, IEPs she would fill out because she was a special education teacher, things she would get for the kids. And then that's where it started to really show signs. Hoarders work in different ways. Some people hoard animals. My mother hoarded things. She just didn't want to throw anything away. So, and she would accumulate things as a teacher, stickers for her students, Jolly Ranchers, Hot Wheels. She dealt with a lot of wonderful young autistic children, and as incentives for them or students overcoming speech difficulties, she would get something that she knew that they loved, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, something. But some of them would be given away and some would accumulate in the house. We had no money, but what little money she had, she spent on discount items at Walmart and Shopko. Those built up. And then finally it spilled over into the appliances. Nothing got replaced. So many things were broken. The dishwasher never got replaced when it broke and it sat. The huge microwave that took up a whole counter in our house, it broke and it sat. Television sets broke and they sat. In that case, when she replaced it, she wouldn't take the old one out. She put like a new little black and white on top of it. So it built up. By the time I was a senior in high school, it was a huge problem where I knew something was wrong, but there wasn't a word for hoarding back then. Now there is.
Right. I wondered about the fact that you experienced all this at a time when there weren't television programs about hoarding, and I'm sure you had really no idea that there were other people suffering as you were, because hoarding occurred behind closed doors. I wanted to especially give you a chance to tell our listeners about an exchange you relate to us in the book. I'm guessing it's maybe one of the relatively few times that you actually confronted your mother about this situation in the home, where you are saying, why can't we have a house where we can walk through the living room? And, she's talking about, well, the vacuum cleaner's broken. Well, we don't have money for a new one. Well, can't we borrow one? And so on. But I find it especially touching when you say to your mother, I just wish we could have a living room like other people do, where people could come over and visit. Tell our listeners what your mother's answer to that completely reasonable question about your living room.
No, I remember distinctly the conversation. She argued, she said, well, other people have living rooms they don't really live in. Consider that. So she really felt like, you know, we were living in this living room and this was our space and she could kind of do with it what she pleased. And the other people, which I have to say, she always had a valid point. She always kind of questioned those homes or those people where, you know, desks, it's nice to have a neat desk, but she always questioned if it was too neat. She always reasoned, and I think there's some truth to that. I think, you know, when people are so, I think just as now we have a word for hoarding, now we know about obsessive compulsive disorder, and some people spend more time cleaning things up than actually maybe getting the work done. I mean, I think there's a happy medium to be found. But my mother really believed, you know, that in her mind, this was the space and this is how we lived. And, you know, it was very unsettling for me as a child. I knew it wasn't quite right. And to your point of what you mentioned earlier, yeah, until those reality shows came on, you just didn't know what was going on. You knew it wasn't quite right, especially as a child. I mean, a child is just learning their ways of the world the whole time. And I think even teenagers are sometimes overestimated. To be clear, I mean, they're wonderful and they're bright and they're gifted and they're adept and they're lovely. But, you know, they're still children learning, you know, kind of what's right, what's wrong on so many levels, including within their own family. So when those hoarding shows came on television, for a heartbeat, I felt relief and I thought, wow, this is great. Now there's a word for what I experienced. People understand that word and I'm not alone. And then quickly that changed to horror and sadness, because I think so much of the nation, it was kind of this rubbernecking mentality that you see around auto wrecks, right, where, you know, people aren't necessarily wanting to stop and help and offer prayers. They're wanting to look and gawk and either feel better about themselves or feel like there's something that they have to tell or gossip about when they get home. And I think that's what's happened with hoarding. There's a lot of judgment, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding with those shows. What I would also say to anyone who maybe has watched those shows and thinks that the whole problem with hoarding is just the piles and piles of junk, that's not the real problem. Anyone who knows or loves a hoarder knows that the junk is just a symptom of the problem that lies within, and that's easier said than done to cure, if you can cure. I mean, that's a debate within the mental health community. What I found fascinating, I thought when I got to a position, I was at Good Morning America, you know, I'd won Emmys, I'd traveled the world, I had gone to Columbia University and done quite well in school, I never got less than an A in my life, I thought, you know, I'm bright, and now I've got these lovely connections, I'm going to call some professionals and we're going to figure this out and we're going to lick my mother's problem. I thought it was going to be slam bam, and it's not like that. My husband made calls, he's an attorney, I made calls, we did talk with my mother, we tried to do anything under the sun, hire maids, get dumpsters there, work to figure out if there was somebody in the neighborhood or the community, if she wouldn't let us come over, that was a big thing. So often with hoarding, there's so much shame. And my mother had a strange combination of both. She had awareness enough to know that she was ashamed. And I think in looking back, I think she was also really conscious that I had found my Prince Charming, my wonderful husband. And I think she was really, worried not only for herself. I think she was also worried for the sake of our relationship, of letting, you know, this wonderful man that was marrying me into all of this. We started to try to help her when we were engaged. And by the way, making lots of trips back to the wonderful city of Milwaukee. One of her things was I wasn't allowed to come home. Her happy medium, and any of you all who know Milwaukee, such a lovely, amazing hotel, my favorite in the whole wide world, is the Pfister. And such a contrast to our house. So our house was, you know, suddenly filled with piles and piles of stuff, and she wouldn't let us in. And, I mean, you couldn't open the front door. She would not let me in, so the last 10 years of her life. And then she would come and look so nice and stay at the Pfister. And some people might say, well, that's just ridiculous. But that was the way that I could see her. That was the way I could visit with her in Wisconsin. Otherwise, she liked to come to visit us in New York. But I've talked to other families of hoarders, and it's very similar. Or even other friends have called me or written to me this week and said, now I understand why your mother always wanted to meet out. She would meet at a park or a restaurant with friends. Nobody ever got to come in. It's a very, very tough situation to take on hoarding, because what the junk is not the problem. The problem is within that person. Something is broken down.
Right.
Something on the mental health level.
And of course, there are some hoarders who live in such conditions and don't seem to genuinely see a problem or don't begin to understand the dimensions of it. It sounds like your mother, at least to some extent, was one of those hoarders who did have a sense that something was wrong, but that doesn't mean she had the emotional or mental wherewithal to really confront it and ultimately do something about it.
That's right. I think, but there was a strange combination, and I think she went back and forth. To be clear, my mother was really brilliant. She was legitimately brilliant, did very, very well in school, met the president when she was in high school, which was an especially big deal back then, before there were as many events as there are now for teenagers and whatnot at the White House. But she, there was something very much, so she was aware to a degree, and then there was denial. One of the conversations I talk about in the book, towards the end of the book, where I'd really had, I had at that point had three small children. We'd had our third. I'd gone back to my high school reunion. My husband and I very much wanted to show the children my childhood home. My husband had never seen the childhood home. Bear in mind, we purposely got married in Milwaukee. I love Milwaukee. Adore it. We got married at the Cathedral, St. John's, downtown, and we had our amazing wedding reception at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We were hoping in getting married back in Wisconsin that we would have, you know, a brunch or a shower or something, and that would be an impetus for her to clean up the house or for us to help her. I mean, bear in mind, the whole time, you know, we were willing to offer money, resources, anything. If she didn't want us to come, you know, we would hire someone. If she didn't want to do it or be there, we would fly her out to be with us. I mean, we tried to do everything, and we had those resources that other families don't have. I'm not saying we had a ton, but we had something, and it was worth it for us. She wouldn't do it. But in any case, when we'd gone back to this high school reunion, she wouldn't let us come into the house. We could only come as far as the driveway. It was, and for her, that was a big step to even let us in the driveway. And I know this may sound crazy, so she entertained us in lawn chairs on the driveway as if it was a living room. And this didn't seem strange at all to her. And that night, it really bothered me. My husband and I had taken her out to dinner. We'd hired a babysitter so we could talk. And she actually, to your point about whether or not she was aware, she did bring up, she said, you know, I've seen those hoarding shows on TV. And my husband and I were shocked, you know. And she said, you know, but I'm not like that. So it was very interesting that she'd seen them, and she registered that maybe we would think that she was like that, but she said, no. She said, I'm just tired. I just haven't gotten around to picking everything up. I think she thought she was just going to get enough energy one day to either let us hire someone, let us come over, or that suddenly she was going to have this energy surge and she was going to pick everything up. And I think that happens, from what I've come to understand in talking to the families of other hoarders, that happens a lot of times where I think there's just lovely, lovely people, but there's some disconnect. There's something broken in terms of, and I think that's a function of also self-preservation.
Mm, of course.
So that they can get through their days, because she did get through the days beautifully and functioned otherwise. She was active in the community. She did volunteer work, which was, you know, so odd. She would volunteer for others, but not for herself.
Mm. You mentioned in the book that your mother, and you just now also mentioned it, that your mother herself was brilliantly gifted, which in many respects makes this feel even more tragic and unfortunate, and that you actually say she would have been an extraordinarily fine journalist. Yes. Had that opportunity really come her way. You mentioned that when you worked at CNN, she loved what you were doing when you were off screen, but once you became an on-screen presence at CNN, somehow that seemed to bother her. And I think you maybe suspect that on some level, the deeper feeling she had of maybe some envy probably began to maybe take over some of the other feelings which she also had about your increasing success?
I think absolutely. It hurt me so much. It still hurt me. Actually, when my manuscript was becoming a book, and I actually sat down with my agent, the wonderful Wiley Agency, that was one of their questions. I said, why do you think she never watched? I mean, it bothered them for me. When I talk about in the book that once I went on camera, it was very odd. I sent her VHS tapes. I was on a show called See It at Newsroom, and it was lovely. It was an opportunity to both be a reporter, and sometimes I filled in as an anchor at the actual CNN news desk, which is very exciting when you're from Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, and you're 23 years old. It's a big deal. But my mother didn't view it as that. She never watched. I reported from all over the place, and she said, understandably, 4:30 in the morning was too early, and she felt overwhelmed about programming the VCR. In hindsight, the VCR may have been broken. A lot of things broke, and she wouldn't tell me. But then I would send her the VHS tapes, and if nothing else, I thought maybe she'd try to watch at the local library or at school, which certainly had VHS devices, maybe a friend's house. She just didn't watch, and it was very hard. I don't fully understand it still. There was even an occasion where I was at my brother's home for a holiday visiting my brother and my nephews, and I was on a show called CNN Earth Matters at the time. It was a lovely show about the environment, and I had a show or Science and Technology Week. It was one of the CNN feature programs. I had a piece coming on live. It was going to be on, I wasn't on live, but the show was actually coming on. And I had my piece. And she left the room. She found a reason to leave the room to not even see it. It was very, obviously, it hurt a lot. And it might suggest to people listening, like, oh, well, that's not a very caring mother. But she was the kind of woman, though, that was so loving. I mean, she didn't begin or end the day without saying, I love you. We talked constantly. But I think mothers and daughters who may be listening may better understand. I think that's where not only the mental illness and any depression may have been creeping in, but also the very complicated nature of mothers and daughters. Some people have compared some parts of the book. I take it as a compliment. I love the film with Shirley MacLaine and Deborah Winger of the 1980s called Terms of Endearment, where it's a very complicated mother-daughter relationship. They love each other very much, but at times there would be this tug of war, and I think mothers and daughters, by nature, we're women, and when we become adult women, there's some jealousy, and sometimes we women sometimes talk about the frenemy relationships. I think that can exist with mothers and daughters, even the most loving ones. So I think there was a lot wrapped up there.
I appreciate the fact that, nevertheless, despite all the dark facets of this story, that it is love that is the predominant theme of this beautiful memoir. Again, titled White Dress is a Memoir of Love and Secrets, Mothers and Daughters, now available in paperback from Wilmore. Mary Flum Peterson, thank you again for writing a truly exceptional book. I am so glad we had this opportunity to speak. Best wishes.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to talk, especially to my native Wisconsin listeners. I love Wisconsin. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I look forward to speaking with Jessica DeBoer, who coordinates the Fine Arts at First series at Carthage College, at First United Methodist Church, that is, talking about their newest season, which begins this weekend. Also, Thomas Carr from the Paleontology Department is joining us on Wednesday's Morning Show to talk about his latest dinosaur dig. We will be talking about Preservation Racine's tour of historic places that's coming up this weekend with Jim Wardrop. And on Friday, Dr. Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit to the program, offering his analysis of current events. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Now to the weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. Today is going to be a sunny day with a high of 72 degrees and light southeasterly winds. Clear tonight with a low of 52 degrees. Sunny tomorrow and a few degrees warmer. Tomorrow's high 75 degrees. And right now it looks like it's going to be a beautiful weekend with, for the most part, dry conditions, and daytime highs should be in the mid to upper 70s. We join Wisconsin Public Radio now for classical music programming. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.